When you know that you are queer, but your favorite drink is beer, that's gayish. You can bottom without stopping, but you can't stand going shopping, that's gayish. Oh, gayish, you're probably gayish. Well, life's just too short for narrow stereotypes, so it's gayish. We're also gayish. It's gayish with Mike and Kyle.
Hello, everyone in the podcast universe. This is Gayish,
the podcast that peers through the window in your hole.
Oh, wait, I have a window in my hole?
Yeah, and I can see right into it.
Ooh, what do you see? What's in there? Is this darkness?
It's just darkness and sadness.
I'm Mike Johnson.
I'm Kyle Getz.
And we're here to bridge the gap between sexuality and actuality. And today, it's not just about my hole.
It could be. Change of plans. This episode is about Mike's hole. Mike, how's your hole?
Great. It's fine.
Okay.
Yeah. How's your hole?
It's wonderful.
Great.
It's chipper today.
It's full of wonder.
Full of wonder.
Great.
But today we're talking about memoirs.
We're going to talk about memoirs, which is a French for a biography, I think. I don't know. It's French for something.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
But first, feedback, corrections, and 100 words. This is a little bit of all of those at the same time. At a certain level of Patreon, if you send in 100 words, I will read them. It's also lovingly known as the Use Mike's Hole benefit. Go ahead and send those in, everybody. Even if you've done it before, I get to decide if there's conflicts. I don't know. Anyway, here we go. This was from John Wong. Here we go. Are you ready, Kyle?
I'm ready.
Okay. Hi, Mike and Kyle and Derek. Just finished the Playboy episode and bonus video, and thank you all for bringing up the Comstock Act. Slight correction, though, on the bonus video. Plan B / the morning after pill is not an abortifacient. It's contraception, as it's meant to prevent fertilization and does not abort a fetus. However, it's absolutely true that many Republicans, including, openly, two Supreme Court justices in a recent case, want to revive the Comstock Act to go after the mailing of medication abortion drugs like mifepristone. While it's unlikely that Justices Alito and Thomas will get their way in the mifepristone case, it is absolutely the case that right-wing conservatives want to revive it and use a potential next Republican president to enforce the Comstock Act on abortion, to ban medication abortion drugs like mifepristone and misoprostol, as well as possibly to ban the mailing of medical tools that could be used for an abortion. They, of course, could go after contraception methods like Plan B next after banning the mailing of any abortion-related materials. Regardless, thanks, Mike, for bringing it up. It's absolutely important to talk about, and of course, ties into my shtick about voting. While voting doesn't solve everything, not voting, or even worse, voting for right-wing a-holes this year means a lot more freedoms will be taken away. Please vote this year in the primary and general election. And also, if people have legal questions about abortion, pregnancy loss, or other pregnancy-related stuff, they can go to www.reprolegalhelpline.org. Thanks again, as always, for the informative and entertaining show. I know this is more than 100 words, but consider this my way of using Mike's hole this week. Winky emoji, best John.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John. I'm glad that you're getting the word out about voting. Because yes, we should do that.
Yep.
Also about the Playboy episode, it's not so much a correction as an oversight. I later found an article where apparently Hugh Hefner's ex-wife, after he died, felt after a couple of years had gone by, it was okay to come forward and say that she's really sure that he was banging dudes, that he used to have dudes come visit and would like kick her out of the bedroom and they would have sexy fun time without her. And she was mad about it, but let it slide until after he was dead.
No way.
Yeah.
That's exciting. We had a discussion on there, whether like what his statement, whether it meant that he was doing gay stuff or not. And I guess he was.
Which he didn't deny doing sexy stuff with other dudes in the room because of swinging. But this was like, she's like, nah, dog, he was banging those boys. So anyway.
Yeah. Good for him.
Okay. Now the news.
Shut your mouth hole. It's time for your ear holes. News. News. News.
Okay. News the first. Are you ready, Kyle?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, great. We should talk about this first just because I think it's the most important. The Biden administration has made changes now to Title IX. that protects trans and non-binary students' bathroom and pronoun use at school. So the U.S. Department of Education announced a final rule under Title IX that protects people in public schools from sex-based discrimination and harassment. It's a big update, right? That there's been this sort of gray area for whether Title IX applies to trans folks or not. And this makes it clear that it absolutely does, except when it comes to sports, which some people are angry that it was chicken shit. But the Biden administration was like, yeah, we couldn't go after trans sports protection this time and have it pass because of the dickbag fuckface assholes that are in Congress. These rules, at the very least, mean that all public schools, K-12 and colleges, students' pronouns and right to use the restroom of the gender with which they identify is protected. And if schools don't toe that line, they risk losing their federal funding, which is a lot.
That's awesome. I mean, mostly awesome.
Yeah.
Except for the athletes part.
Yeah. Which I do think, you know, there is a pragmatism that I think we have to be mostly okay with, right? Like if it's past some protections, we shouldn't say, well, you should have done all of them or none of them, right? If this is what could get passed, then this is what could get passed.
Yeah, I guess so. This is like a metaphor for why we're voting for Joe Biden,
right?
Because it's the best we can do for now.
Yep, absolutely. He's what we've got. Mm-hmm. Okay, news the second. Malik Pancholi, who you might know as Kenneth from 30 Rock, has been uninvited to speak at a school district in Cumberland Valley, Pennsylvania. He was scheduled to speak next month at Mountain View Middle School in Mechanicsburg about his experiences with bullying and the importance of empathy and inclusion. But the school board voted unanimously to cancel the event, citing concerns that his LGBTQ+ advocacy would be too political for a school setting. There was a community backlash about letting a faggot talk to kids, I guess. There is a petition that the community is putting together to reinstate the event, but the Cumberland Valley Board has been saying that we don't care. And now John Fetterman apparently is involved somehow. Senator John Fetterman, the Democrat known for wearing hoodies to Congress, has openly now criticized the school district, saying that removing this invitation was deeply wrong and a detriment to students' education on diversity and bullying. He's on Threads, which I guess he's the only one, expressing his concern and urging them to reconsider. Anyway, I really just put this story in here because it's Kenneth from 30 Rock, and I know you love the show.
Yeah, I saw this. That's really frustrating. Like, just by virtue of who we are, our identities are politicized. Like, we're controversial just by existing as gay people, and that can get us canceled.
And that's why we have to be given that microphone, I think, right? Like this is the problem with people and their kids and their relationship to school districts. This whole like parental choice fucking horse shit that dickbag fuckface assholes like to talk about. Sometimes your shitty ass kid needs to be exposed to shit that you're just going to. Like, we're going to teach your kid some shit because it's real. Gay people exist. Mm-hmm. We're real. You just, like, it's not our job to not tell your kids shit because you're an asshole.
Yeah.
And I think forcing the issue is sometimes necessary. And I'm trying to think of an example where it might go the other way. Like, if they wanted to start saying, like, we can't talk about the existence of Christians in schools, I would be against that also. Right. Like,
right.
Christians exist. Most of them are dumb, but like, we can't pretend they don't exist so that your stupid atheist kid doesn't have to experience that content. I don't know. Just like, get over yourselves, parents. Schools are supposed to teach what society needs taught, not what you want your shitty kid to not hear.
Right. Totally.
Great. Scintillating conversations. Sorry, Kyle. I have a delay on my internet. Okay, news the last.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure that I've talked about them before. If I haven't, it's another group. If I have, it's the same group doing shit again. But there is a group of there's a group of gay furry hackers called SiegedSec, and they have hacked and doxed people's data from far right media outlet Real America's Voice.
Real America's Voice. They just came up with the first idea they had and went with it. They should really think about that name. It doesn't roll off the tongue.
Real America's Voice or RAM. Nope, that's not what that spells. RAV. Okay.
RAV.
Anyway, businessman Robert Sigg owns the right-wing media outlet, and they regularly platform far-right commentators like Steve Bannon, Charlie Kirk. They have pushed conspiracy theories like COVID-19 misinformation, 2020 election conspiracies, QAnon horseshit, of course, obviously a bunch of transphobic and anti-LGBT content. So this group of gay furry hackers targeted them and then released the personal information of over 1,200 app users, included their full names, phone numbers, and email addresses. I don't know how I feel about that. Mm. The group also said that they, quote, went poof on their files and wiped a bunch of data from the app's API and its cloud storage. They said, throughout our attacks on transphobic entities, we have received concerns that our attacks will be used to label the LGBTQ plus community as terrorists and criminals. The thing is, these types of people will blame the LGBTQ plus community regardless of what we do. They will look for a reason to hate. They won't listen to reason. They want to spread lies to shun people different than them. And they also made headlines in November 2023 when they hacked into the biggest nuclear laboratory in the United States and demanded that its employees focus on research into real life cat girls. They posted to about the hack and in cat language. They
what is cat language?
They boasted about the attack of INL's data in public posts that began meow 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 meow. Meow meow. I don't know, man. Like, I think I don't know if I would advocate for the methods that they're employing, but also like they're definitely attacking the right people. I don't know how to feel about it, Kyle.
Yeah, hacktivist groups are a challenge because they're not regulated by anyone, so they're just, which is partially why they can do what they do, and it feels good when they're hacking the people that you're against. So until they go after someone you like, then it's feels like a good thing. But yeah, it's tricky to know how to feel about this kind of activism.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I feel like right-wing people are dum-dums and that they're less good at security. I think they might be easier targets.
Like they're worse at the internet.
That's totally just my bias coming through.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's it. That's the news.
That's the news. Speaking of people that we would like to talk to in cat language, I want to thank the following meow new Patreon members. Thank you to Jerome Gualama.
Nailed it.
Probably. And Troy Jones.
That was easy.
Yep. If you want bonus episodes a day early, if you want to use Mike's hole, if you want to support the show, go to patreon.com/gayishpodcast.
Do it.
Do it.
You want to talk about memoirs?
Yeah, let's talk about memoirs.
All right. Well, we are going to have with us a known memoir writer named Stan Zimmerman. Mm-hmm. And he's going to come on and talk about his book, The Girls from Golden to Gilmore. And that's his book it's a memoir, but talks about him being a writer on a bunch of really, really awesome shows that many of us know and love, including Golden Girls.
Golden Girls, Gilmore Girls. He wrote on Roseanne. He wrote one of the Brady Bunch movies. So he's written a lot of stuff that you may know.
Yeah. And. Oh, he's also gay.
He's also gay.
Which is important.
Which is important to this show.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that, do we have more to say? Are memoirs gay? I hope he helps us figure that out.
Being a writer is kind of gay already. So writing about your own life, being gay, I think, gives you content to write about for your memoir. Because you can write about like all the shitty things people did to you because you were gay. I think is part of what was included in Stan's memoir.
Yep. Yep. Well, okay, let's just get to it then.
Yeah, let's do it.
When we're going to take a break. When we get back, we're going to have Stan Zimmerman with us to talk about all things writing and memoir-y. So let's take a break.
Let's take a break.
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 Thank you for taking a break.
This is the part where Mike and Kyle take a break.
So are we back?
We're back.
We're back. We are here with Stan Zimmerman. Welcome to the show, Stan. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Okay, let's just jump right into it. You are based in Los Angeles. You said you're spitting distance from Hollywood right now.
I'm in Hollywood near the Hollywood Bowl. I also just started a timeshare at a place in New York City. So I went to NYU. I kind of feel like a New Yorker. People think I'm a New Yorker. And I want to spend more time back there, hopefully getting more involved in theater. And I just, when I land, I feel like I'm at home.
What's gayer, LA or New York?
Oh, geez. They're very, very, very different. I mean, you see more gay, I guess, because you're walking on the street and you're bumping into people and it's just very fashionable and cool. But, you know, then you'll read a license plate that's like, well, that could be any gayer. Or you see, you know, a certain kind of car or, you know, people just talking on their phone while they're driving. And that's pretty gay. So both has its advantages as far as the gay world. You know, it's very out in the open, you know, as opposed to still when I go home. I mean, I'm a Midwestern boy, grew up in a suburb of Detroit, 10 Mile, if you're thinking Eminem in that area. just for those references, you know, there was always, you know, you live in your house, you shut the door, what happens behind your door, that's your business. Where I feel like in New York, LA, probably even in Miami or in bigger cities, it's just much more, you know, out in the open and kind of okay. But in any city, you still have to be careful, unfortunately, still where you walk, what you do.
Yeah. So growing up gay in Detroit, what's that like?
In going back and writing this book, I had to go back into my childhood. And, you know, people find it so hard to believe back then how closeted we all had to live. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, people are so shocked when they find out that writing on Golden Girls, even though it was season one, we were told to stay in the closet and not say you were gay on such a progressive show. But it was just a different time then. And people have asked, how could you be so creative? And you know, in creativity and artistry, you have to open yourself up and be an open vessel in a way, and yet we so much of our lives were shut down. So it got me thinking, as I'm doing this little book tour, realizing I had so many years to perfect that hiding and deflecting and being you know, gay with my friends and most of my family, but in the world it was still, that was just not talked about. And how do you survive and be creative and successful and all of that? And it was so nice to finally start breaking down those barriers back then, against all odds, appearing in a local independent newspaper in LA with our picture on the back lot at Warner Brothers. And we were a gay writing duo, like in comedy, that just wasn't heard of. I don't even know if there were any before us.
I want to ask, who is it that's telling you you need to stay in the closet? Like, are there people who are explicitly like saying with their words, you need to stay in the closet? Or is it more an implication?
Agents. Okay. Representatives. So you figure they know they have the key to your next job. Also, a lot of these people were gay themselves. Or they were development executives. We had a mentor who was gay, Gary Keeper. And it was just common knowledge. That's what you did. But they would say, oh, well, you have a big party for one of your first shows, a premiere party. You need to bring a woman. Even up until on Roseanne, we got nominated for a Writers Guild Award for the Don't Ask, Don't Tell episode, which is also known as the Lesbian Kiss episode. Mm-hmm. And I brought Margaret Cho with me, who was a friend at the time. And I didn't have a boyfriend. I will give you that. And I really just loved hanging out with her. But it still makes you think, like, there was still a little residue of that. If you were going to something so public, it'd probably be better if you were with a woman.
Mm-hmm. You've mm-hmm. mentioned that there was at least one golden girl that figured out that you were gay early on.
Yes. And of course, that would be Estelle Getty, the, yeah. One of the ally of all allies. And she, you know, was doing little teeny off-Broadway plays. And then she happened to luck into being Harvey Fierstein's mom in Torch Song Trilogy off-Broadway. And then that exploded on Broadway, which I saw it. I had moved to LA, but I'd come back to New York where my writing partner was still living. And he said, oh, I got us tickets to this little show that's exploded on Broadway. I knew nothing about it. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I see this little woman come on stage and Harvey's, you know, huge. And seeing them as mother and son, they were just hysterical together. I had no idea that a year and a half later I would be writing for her. But one of the first days on set, she came up to us and she's teeny tiny. And she said, psst, come here. And she starts like walking away. And Jim and I are looking at each other. Where's she going? She said, follow me. And we followed her around the set. And she's like, psst, come, you know, come down to her height, which is like four something. And she said, your secret's safe with me. And Jim and I kind of looked at each other and we're like, that we're Jewish? And she's like, no, that you're gay, you know? And like, I know, you know, all my friends are gay and I got you, you know, I got your back. And so there was still that idea that you had to keep it a secret, but it was so great that she was like, you know, always winking at us. And so that we instantly became fast friends and our friendship grew even after we were not on the show in further seasons. And stayed in touch with her and you know, got to do different events with her. And I just adore her. And I really respect that at night after rehearsals of Golden Girls, she would go and do AIDS benefits. And there were so few stars of note that would put their face or names to an AIDS benefit. And she was just out there wanting to do everything she could do to save lives.
I can only imagine how like comforting that must have been to have that little secret moment of trust, like that in this environment that you're describing of be sure to stay in the closet, that to have that sort of confidant, it must have been a relief.
It was a relief, but then we'd go into the writer's room and at the time Jim and I were sharing the bottom half of a house in Silver Lake. And Silver Lake was kind of known as the gay area. And one day we came in on a Monday and people said, what did you do? And we said, we went to this garage sale. And I said, I got all these vintage sweaters. And all the writers, like their eyes bugged out. And I said, well, it was a yard sale, a garage sale, because the guy died of AIDS. You have to go home and burn those sweaters.
Oh my God.
And back then, again, you didn't know that much about it. And we're like, oh, my God, what? I didn't burn them, but I remember putting them in a garbage bag and tying it tight and throwing them out. I'd never wore them, you know. So, again, it was that fear. And think about, like, the early days of COVID. We just didn't know. We're washing down all the stuff, grocery bags and things. So I think it is important to talk about that, and that's why I did include it in my book, so that younger people know the history of where we came from, where we are. Many places were still the same. The fact that we're, you know, fighting, you know, for trans rights and drag queens to read books in schools. I mean, there's still this notion, and that has not changed, that if you talk about being gay, oh my God, it's so exciting. You're going to have to, suddenly kids are going to become gay. That is such, still such an odd, philosophy to think when actually talking about it or seeing drag queens, maybe these kids will actually learn about tolerance and acceptance and that there are many kinds of people in visibility. And that's why I think you dealt with this earlier in your program about my friend Malik Pancholi being canceled to speak at a middle school. And I did a little Instagram thing. No, visibility saves lives. And I think that's what he's been fighting for, as am I with my suicide awareness play right before I go, which Malik acted in in New York at Town Hall a few years ago.
The school board in Pennsylvania that voted to exclude him from speaking at that middle school, They kept using the word lifestyle over and over again about that being, it's his lifestyle that we're worried about being promoted. And I thought we gave up on the fucking word lifestyle in the 90s. Like,
here, yeah, but that here feels it is. Super old school.
Yeah. Right. Not to them, it wasn't. Right. There is still this old generation that still looks at it as a lifestyle. I don't care if you're born with it, if you chose it, who the fuck cares? Yeah, if yeah. you want to say I'm gay or identify gay, or you want to, like, you know, I guess I can say it on here, like, suck cock, enjoy, go ahead. You know, I'm sure there are many people, including some, you know, senators and congressmen, that wouldn't mind meeting you in some bathroom at Dulles Airport. no names. Like, let people just live. Why haven't we gotten to that place yet? I just, you know, but the fight goes on. It does go on. And each time we think, it's going to, like, all right, we're there. Oh, no, here we go again. And
it has felt very two steps forward, one step back, you know, throughout history. And it does feel like we're in a taking a step back moment right now. And it's hard to hang on to that hope that this is an oscillation, that, like, it will get better. The long arc of history has been in a good direction. But, man, things are rough right now.
Yeah, I didn't understand it because I felt like with Bill Clinton, we're kind of like, oh, okay. And not to name drop again, but I happened to be going to dinner with Lily Tomlin and her partner, Jane Wagner. Mm-hmm. It was like, I think it was like when the first Bush came back in. I'm going, explain. Like, you two are one of the greatest minds of my lifetime. Like, just help me. I don't get it. And they said, you have to think of politics like a pendulum. And it's like, once I got that, I'm like, I could relax a little bit. So, like, you know, Obama was, you know, we pushed him and we went that way. And then all of a sudden we end up with this orange one. And then, like, kind of like back, and people keep pushing it this way. We've just got to be like, no, we're not going back to that. And it means, you know, everybody getting out and voting.
Yeah. Yep.
What was it like for you growing up, going to school, being bullied? How was growing up gay for you?
Again, it was hard in my little complicated head with, believe it or not, a Jew fro. I did have, like, big curly puffy Q-tip look. Nice. Now it just got tired and it's just doing whatever I fucking want to do. But back then, it was very hard in my little mind to wanting to figure out why, when I went to school, I would be bullied, I would be spit on. And then I went to the summer theater camp and I was the most loved person there. Mm-hmm. And so you're going, I'm the same person. Why in one environment do they not respect me or see me? And then the other, I'm finding my tribe. And I did through theater and doing plays. And that was my saving grace. I don't think I would be alive today if I didn't have theater and everything that brought me, friends, laughter, joy, appreciation of my creativity. But, you know, kids are really cruel. You know, how do you go home? And I never told my mother that I was spit on in school. It wasn't until later years. And she was like, why didn't you tell me? I'm like, what could I have even said back then? I was too afraid to even say, I think I'm gay, or I'm gay, or why they are calling me that. So I would just go up into my bedroom, shut the door, and use my imagination, where I created my own TV network, which I'm sure most kids do, and 7 days a week of programming. And of course, I gave Lily Tomlin her own 1-hour variety show, because
great.
That's what she do. And I felt I needed to, the world needed to see her genius once a week. And I got to tell her that, which was really cool. And lots of different shows that I created, or if there was a show that got canceled that I really liked, I would put it on my own network. And and so that working in television just felt like something, of course, that's going to happen one day. And I was lucky that it did.
So it sounds like this was always your path, or always what you thought you'd be doing.
Well, I wish I was taller and could be a fashion model, but that was not to be. being 5'8 and a half. So that was not. Then I thought I'd be like a background dancer on a TV variety show. Mm-hmm. But I didn't start taking dance classes actually till NYU times. And I got to study with Joffrey Ballet. And then I, with them, I got to kind of dance in the background or move with Rudolph and Ray out front. So that was very exciting to have that tiny, tiny experience.
Mm-hmm. And what was your break? When did you get your break? How did it happen?
The first break was getting our first TV show. So I moved out to LA, and in less than a year, we got offered two TV series. One, probably one of the little regrets that I had, it starred Madeline Kahn. It was an ABC TV show, and she was just a friggin' genius. And I kind of wish we had done that show, but we went where our mentor was producing a show, and we took that job at ABC. The show we filmed 13 episodes, but it, I think, only aired 7 or 8. But from that, we got a pilot at CBS, started doing, so that was our big break. And that was like the job when I was working at the Vista Movie Theater. We got the job on a Thursday, I think. And I went to the job, handed in the keys, and they said, you know, we know Hollywood. Why don't you keep the keys? You'll probably be coming back here to work for us in a couple of months. I was determined there was no fucking way I was coming back there. I was like, I'm done. I'm out. And I gave them the keys, flew to New York for the weekend, came back, and never looked back, really.
Back to the Golden Girls. Why are gays so obsessed with Golden Girls?
Well, you tell me. Why are you obsessed with it? Are you obsessed with it?
Well, for me, I was a kid in the 80s, and I loved it because my grandmother, my very conservative Catholic grandmother, fucking loved that show. So we would just snuggle up on the couch and watch this show. And so I've got that's not even part of the queer experience. That's just bonding with my grandmother. I do think that gay men are sort of enamored by powerful women. That seems to be a theme.
Well, I've heard lots of stories about LGBTQ youth being with their conservative grandmothers mostly. Mm-hmm. And I really think, you know, there was a moment when obviously the show had a queer sensibility, even though Jim and I were the only queer writers on it for the first season. It wasn't until Mark Cherry came on years later. But that you could sit there and you could laugh together. And then it wasn't like, even though you felt differences, you know, politically, like there was a common ground. I think it gave us hope. And then also, I think back then, well, for people that lived in that time, we were losing a lot of people in AIDS and worrying about, would we even live to be that old? And then who would take care of us and who would we live with? So that four people came together to form like their own family was kind of a new concept. And I think it gave a lot of us, and still does, hope that in the end, we don't want to be alone, that we will find, you know,
family, some others,
family, you know, and maybe a crazy mother and, you know, and lots of sex coming in that door. Yeah.
It's so weird to me that I'm 45 and I'm rapidly approaching the age that they were supposed to be. Like, what constitutes golden, I think, has shifted in the last 40 years or whatever.
Well, I've seen a lot of memes where they had pictures of J-Lo, like, on a stripper pole and saying she was the same age as Rue McClanahan when the show started. And you're just like, how could that be? And they say that, like, your hairstyles really, you know, can make you look older. And those hairstyles were so old looking. One joke that never made it in, which I really pushed for, was that Betty White's hair looked like George Washington's. Oh. I made a joke about it. I'm like, I don't think Betty would like it. I'm going, oh, but it's okay to make fun of B. Arthur, but don't make fun of Betty White. But it didn't move. It never moved. It was just like, you know, it was very, very strange shape. And, you know, they've done many pictures. If you had taken those ladies' faces and had contemporary hairdos, they would look probably 20 years younger.
Yeah.
And you do see, like, when they're all made up for the Emmys or whatever, that they're clearly not the characters that they were made up to be.
The story goes that Estelle, I think, was a year younger than Bea Arthur. And then between season 1 and 2, I guess she got a facelift and she didn't tell anybody, and she comes to work and they're like, well, there's another hour of makeup we're going to have to do before to get her to look like that. Oh, I know. You didn't know that part,
didn't know
huh?
that. No.
Yeah. And I don't know what work any of them did after. I mean, they look fantastic. And I got to love them because unlike any other show I've ever been involved with, almost every interview you see with them, they compliment the writers first and they give us the credit. It isn't about them. It's about we had these great words to say. And that's such a cool thing. You know, maybe it's because they were older actors and they really did appreciate good writing. And it was consistently really top-notch writing. We knew we couldn't go home. It had to be the best of the best jokes because we had the best of the best actors.
Yeah. Well, and there's such a dearth of roles for women of a certain age, much less good roles and good roles in a group like that. It's a magical combo.
It was. I guess originally they never thought Bea Arthur would do a show because after Maud, she's like, I'm done. I don't want to do another long running show. And then the script that Susan Harris so beautifully did in the pilot, she wrote Dorothy as a Bea Arthur type. Mm. And I guess Rue McClanahan, her friend from Maud, read the show and she called her up and said, Bea, I don't care. You have to read this script. Like, this is really good. And that's how we got Bea Arthur in the show.
So did you have anything to do with writing for Coco, the character Coco?
No, we did not come on the show until, that was in the pilot, Coco. And then they realized that they didn't need another character because Estelle Getty's character was so funny and she was supposed to be just like a guest star in it. And they're like, no, that's the winning combination. So they did eliminate Coco by the time we went in and pitched. So the show got picked up and then they have writers come in and pitch different stories. And we luckily sold one and wrote a freelance script. And they liked the first rough draft of it so much that they brought us on staff right away. But we started going to all the tapings before it started airing in September. So we kind of saw where the show was going. I often brought up, like, let's explain the disappearance of Coco. And they didn't want to have anything to do with it. They were like, it's done, he's gone, boom. You know, and it was a different time then because you only saw the shows in reruns. It wasn't like you could watch it, you know, on Hulu every night. So I thought it'd been fun to have them back and do a fun episode, but they never bought those pitches.
Yeah. I sort of wonder, like, an openly gay character at that moment in time seems so implausible that would ever make it to air. And then it did in the pilot. But then I wonder who writes that character, because like to your point of agents saying you have to stay in the closet, who writes gay characters in the 80s?
Well, we would. They wouldn't even probably think of that. I mean, they would probably just think, well, Susan Harris wrote the Billy Crystal character in Soap was one of the first gay characters on a TV show. I assume if they had kept Coco, they probably would have looked for some gay writers. And there was one or two where there'd be like half a writing team that was gay. A couple, you know, men that wrote on their own. I'm sure there must have been some lesbians that were writers. But not many. It just wasn't. It was thought of as like an old boys network. You know, I'd even read somewhere that on all of Gary Marshall's shows that the writing staff in between writing scenes would go play basketball outside. And so I was like, well, I can't play basketball, so I can't be a writer. I mean, it was that kind of, you know, oh, that jock thing again. Oh, then they're going to play dodgeball and I'm going to be hit in the head. And living those memories all over again. Although I learned to catch the ball in dodgeball. Like I used my tiny little body, like, and I was red there for, you know, for like a month. I caught it and, you know, that fucking asshole that threw it at me that thought he was going to like, you know, knock me to the floor. He was not happy about that. But it was survival.
My boyfriend plays gay dodgeball, and there's a lot of like aggression that gets taken.
Oh, I'm sure that game. I mean, how many nightmares have you had about that game? Just that, and then the skins and shirts thing. That I couldn't like. I had to take my shirt off. Are you kidding me? Yeah, you know, that was suddenly when I get hives and have to go to the school nurse or something, or a sudden it's like coughing fit.
I mean this in the nicest way possible. I don't know a lot of writers that I want to see shirtless, you know? Like,
how dare you? Yeah, there's no Writers Guild nude calendar, is there? Right. I think it would be like January, maybe around Thanksgiving, or No, it was probably too much eating back then. I'll get on that right away. Yeah.
Same with podcasters for what it's worth.
Yeah.
Okay. I definitely want to make sure that we get a chance to talk about Roseanne. You also wrote for Roseanne, but there's no overlap there, right? Or was there? Like, were you writing for both shows at the same time? I'm trying to remember, did they ever air at the same time?
No, that was many, 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 many years apart, I think. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I think one was 80s, one was 90s.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. If I do recall. Yeah, no, Roseanne, we got offered the pilot of Roseanne before Lori Metcalf and John Goodman were attached. And they wanted this crazy deal with like 7-year commitment. And we just were very excited to be creating our own material in. So we said no.
Hmm.
Loved the show. Loved her. Always thought she'd be... From the minute I saw her stand up, I knew she could be a TV star, even though everybody around us said nobody wants to watch someone that looks like that on TV. But they were wrong. And then it came back to us in season 5, and our agents went hard in to get us that job. It just was like, this is the kind of show we liked. It was in the vein of like a Norman Lear show, which I grew up on and loved. It was dealing with real people and middle class Midwest, where I came from. Mm-hmm. And he fought hard and got us a gig. And we got on there, and we were pretty miserable on the show. It was 21 writers. Most of them were stand-up comedy friends of Tom Arnold and Roseanne's. Mm-hmm. So they weren't really experienced writers at the time, but they were brilliantly funny, like a Norm Macdonald and Laura Keitlinger and Pat Bullard. So we kind of had to teach them about writing. I loved the show, but there was just no respect, no acknowledgement of your hard work. She was always mistrusting of the writers. We got friendly with Tom Arnold, and he was really cool. And he did keep that engine going. And it's a lot of work to keep a show going and to do, you know, now... Some shows are like 10 episodes a season, and oh, they're so tired. You know, we would do like 22 to 26 episodes. That's a lot. I mean, you know, by the time you start it in July, you get to March, April, and you're just dizzy, and you know, you have no life, and it's exciting, but it is it's a trade-off. And then you're kind of done. My writing partner was so done with all of that. But luckily we did meet Amy Sherman Palladino on that show, which did lead eventually to Gilmore Girls.
So I think of Roseanne Arnold, Roseanne Barr as being really progressive in the '90s. And then she's landed where she's landed now, which is decidedly in the other direction.
Yeah. There are mental health reasons around that. I mean, you can't watch her podcast or some of those crazy videos that she's making. And she is very open about her mental health issues. I mean, back in the day, she was writing books about multiple personalities. And, you know, the guests that she has on her shows, like Carrie Lake, and I mean, just, you know, really some cuckoo people.
But she's like emblematic of things that I've seen with like my family or like the QAnon conspiracy folks. There's a whole Reddit about like, I lost my dad to this craziness. Like, she's not the only one. Like, what's going on? We can't have half the country with mental health problems, or maybe we can. I don't know.
You know, she blamed it on Ambien, that first tirade, you know, that got her fired. I mean, that's a big question. You know, I have a lot of discussions with, I'm very much into politics, and I have MSNBC on like pretty much all day long. Do you want to figure a way to reach those people, or are those people just, you know, clueless? And you've seen so many videos, at least I have. I just saw one yesterday where they showed a clip, they faked Trump just saying the most horrible things. And in this group of, you know, like a research group, they all had excuses for it. You're like, still? I mean, he was saying awful things about wanting to sleep with his daughter. And they're like, well, he's a red-blooded man. And they're like, it's his daughter. Yeah. Like,
oh my God.
It didn't matter. They had just like, I just feel like somehow their people just got into their really strong camps And I know there's an intersection of like good in there. So where do we find that intersection? Let's just start from that. But when you see so many people like with Roseanne now, and that, you know, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, they're not talking about solutions. They're just screaming and being loud. And the louder they are, the more they get covered in media and the more money they get in. So it's not about solving problems. Politicians should be there to solve problems. You know, she used to be about entertaining and enlightening people and getting people to think. And now she's just about screaming her point of view out there. How is that helpful? I don't know. It's one thing to have a different opinion of how we all reach happiness, but it's another to create people that are othered and put down other people and not respect any, you know, all people, no matter what, back to your lifestyle or whatever, however you choose to live your life. Let's put it that way. Yeah.
There's the whole thing about like when you're writing jokes, are you punching up or are you punching down? And, you know, having respect for making sure that you're not picking on people lower on the ladder in order to get your point across or make points. And
yes, I didn't always see that. I thought you had to be like mean and bitter and sarcastic. And really when I moved to LA, I just thought I'll move to LA. What if I lose my bite, my New York bite? And I just started reading a lot of books like Louise Hay and even Shirley MacLaine, and you know, and she had all these like past lives, and it just opened my mind to so many people can believe different things. If it works for them, God love them. You don't have to put them down for it. If it's working for them and not hurting you. And that was just a new way of thinking. And you can still be very dry and sarcastic without it being mean to people. And that kind of humor, I just don't like. You know, who was that guy that did, what was the Golden Globes this year? Remember that host, and he just came out and started making fun of everybody.
Oh, like, Ricky, you know, Gervais?
No, it was somebody else.
Oh.
I forgot his name. Anyway, and then he blamed the writers. Like, oh, God, don't do that. Like, take credit. And then he said, oh, well, I just got the job, like, you know, a month ago. Then don't take the job. I mean, we've thrown scripts out in the night and had to rewrite a whole script in a day. So you heard the jokes, you know the audience you're going in front of. I think you can poke fun without being mean. And there's just some people that it's just a meanness that I don't really need to be around or hear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
So tell us about writing for Gilmore Girls. How is that different than the other kind of jobs you've had, or what was it like writing for them?
Again, on that show, it was going into season 5. So there were 4 seasons and they were hour shows, and I only watched the pilot. So I had to, in a weekend, binge all those shows. And I just fell in love with it. I just love the writing. I love the speed of the talking. The actors are amazing. Amy Sherman Palladino's writing is extraordinary. She created just this magical world that I wanted to be a part of. And it was really difficult because it is a lot of words. And it was her vision, which was so specific. And so I think that's why she asked me and Jim to come on staff, because she had burned through a lot of writers that weren't quite getting what she wanted. It's really hard to find writers to get your vision and to write a good first draft. And so we were honored that she asked us, and we took a year out of our development life to go on that. I'm so glad I did. I met great people. I learned a lot about writing, planting stories and seeing the seeds come up later, and just met a lot of great friends that I've been putting in my plays and have become like family to me, really.
And where along the way did you come out? We kind of skipped over your coming out story, or have we yet?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's so unimportant. where it came out? Well, between Golden Girls and Roseanne, really. You know, okay. Friends knew, then family. That was kind of a little tough, just because, you know, you want their acceptance and their love. My parents were divorced by that point. My father's reaction was, he said, I just want my son back, which was very, you know, a lot of tears. And then, cause I was obviously holding back who I was. He didn't like, where was that fun boy? And my mom's was very like, I didn't know if you were and I didn't know if you weren't. I'm like, okay, well, I am. I always felt that she loved having like a gay son. I think she, you know, we just had this amazing relationship, and I was always there for her. And, you know, I think in a way she kind of liked that I was perpetually single, so that we would just always be able to hang out. And, you know, she ended up moving to Santa Barbara so I could see her a lot, and she could come down to all the tapings and eventually come down to all my plays. And so I felt so lucky that I had that person in my life for so long, and kind of really made me who I am today.
Your mom, which Golden Girl is she most like? That's a fun party question for the gays.
Not Blanche, that's for sure. She wasn't Dingy, so not Rose. I guess a Dorothy or I guess a Dorothy and turning into Sophia.
Okay.
Yeah. Although sometimes, like when she would go out, she kind of turned into a Rose and she would just talk to anybody. And she was like, okay, mom, like we can sit down now. You don't have to become best friends with, you know, people at Bed Bath and Beyond. although they're wonderful people there. But it was always fun to like see her in public. I think also because she is a little bit of a loner like myself and always lived alone, that when she went out, she was just like chatty, chatty.
And which Golden Girl are you?
What do you think?
I don't know. I'm not getting Blanche energy either.
How dare you? Maybe in a couple hours and a martini, then I turn to Blanche, yes.
That's true for everybody, maybe.
yeah, probably Dorothy. I mean, I'm just very to the point and no bullshit, and I don't like wasting my time.
Yeah.
But there definitely is a little bit of Blanche, and probably Sophia too. But yeah, I guess I've always been such a huge fan of Bea Arthur's, and I mean, the fact that I was even in rooms with her still boggles my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about your book. So your memoir, The Girls from Golden to Gilmore. There it is.
There it is. Right there. Yeah,
so the big fight about this with the publishers, stories about all the wonderful women I've worked with. Uh-huh. Anne Roseanne.
Yeah.
I wanted the Anne Roseanne here. And my publishers were like, oh my God, what is she going to do? What is she going to say? I'm like, bring it on. I'll take her. there would be like a cage match, huh? I feel like she wouldn't fight fairly. I feel like there would be biting or something involved.
My money's on you, I think.
Really? Okay, I like that.
Yeah.
I would get out so much aggression because I can't tell you the PTSD I have working with actors, because starting with her, yeah. I mean, she had all the actors on set living in fear. I was friends with Sandra Bernhardt, but when I came down to set, Sandra would be like, don't talk to me. I don't want to get fired, and you don't want to get fired. And, you know, the first time I saw Laurie Metcalf, I just ran up to her like, oh my God, I saw you in New York and blah, 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 blah. No, it was known that Roseanne did not trust the writers. So she was always looking to see who's talking to them. You know, are they talking behind my back? And so add paranoia into the other things that she's now going through.
That kind of checks out. In a way, the paranoia thing. Yeah. So why did you decide to write a memoir, and how long did it take you? Have you been planning this for a long time or?
Yes. It took over 7 years. So I had the idea, just because I always would get asked questions of like, how could you as a man write for all these women? And it wasn't just Golden Girls, but then it started being like almost all the shows that we worked on, including last year, Jim and I wrote a Lifetime Christmas movie called The Diva's Christmas with Donna Mills and Nicolette Sheridan and Linda Gray and Morgan Fairchild and Lonnie Anderson. So it was like, here we go again. so I wanted to answer that question. And so then I went back. I had kept journals during all these years. I went back and pulled all the journal entries from the TV shows that I worked on because I wanted to compare where I was back then to how I'm feeling now and how you grow. And then it really became a memoir of how do you pick yourself up and keep going and reinvent yourself in any job, not just show business. And then not realizing I didn't even know. I had outlined it, but not really had an ending to it. And unfortunately, the ending became the death of my mother and the realization that she was my one true golden girl. And so that I wish I didn't have that as the ending of my book, but it's what happened in real life. And so I decided to chronicle that and put in my journal entries. And I think it's very relatable for people. There's so many people dealing with grief and figuring out how to move forward through it and getting through the really bad days. And there's some days where you're like, okay, or you're feeling like, yeah, I feel her. I have her, you know, she's pushing me forward. And then other days I'm like, you know, do I want to live in a world where she's not here? I mean, that was my initial reaction, to be completely honest. So I made the mistake or the good fortune of mentioning that I was writing a book, one of the early Gilmore Girl fan festivals. So then every year I would go back. The first question was like, where's the book? When are you going to do it? Well, I've outlined it. Well, I'm working on getting it to finding a publisher. And then somehow magically during COVID, I just buckled down. I was stuck in your house and I got a publisher. And then I was just, okay. Every day I created a spot where I would go, which wasn't my usual spot to sit in. And I had my espresso or sugar-free Red Bull, my computer. And I just get a chapter. And then suddenly I had the whole book.
What are the differences? What are the biggest challenges compared to writing for TV or for theater?
Well, it's extremely difficult because first of all, it's your own life. You know, I take pieces of my own life and use it in the different plays and TV shows and movies I write. But this was it. And it was very easy for me to say, oh, I did this, I did that. And my publishers kept saying, can you write it as a scene? And also I'd always written with somebody else except for my one play. So it was very difficult to like, oh, I don't want to write alone. But I pushed forward and created a lot of them as more scenes than just he did this, they said that, blah, blah, blah. But it was really, really hard. I don't know if I would ever do it again, but never know. Maybe there's a book about the men in my life.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, there you go. A little spicy.
Yeah.
So Stan, before we go to break, I just want to ask you for a writer who is thinking of getting started and they're worried about Gen AI taking their job, generative AI, what would you say? What's your advice?
Keep writing. As much as AI can create kind of format, it will never be the same as what we feel here or here. That's something, you know, the commonality people find in all my work, whether it's drama or comedy, they say, we can feel your heart. Well, AI does not have a heart. They will never have a heart. They can't recreate what that heart is. And that's something that it just comes out in my work. You just get that sense that I care and that I'm sensitive. And I don't think that can ever be replaced. You can get kind of the jokes, but that piece is always what's going to make it special. So don't worry about that. Just turn on your computer and just start and realize that writing is rewriting.
Did we do it, Kyle?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did it.
We did it.
Damn it.
Yeah.
What you do at the end of having sex? Did we do it? I think we did it. You go get the washcloth because I don't know.
Yeah. Let's take a break and get a washcloth then.
Okay, there you go.
Let's take a break.
This is the part where Mike and Kyle take a break.
So are we back?
We're back.
We're back.
We're going to do our gayest and straightest.
We're going to do our gayest and straightest. But first, Stan Zimmerman, where can people find out more about you, what you're working on? Tell us all the things.
Facebook, what I love. Instagram, ZimmermanStan.com. It's reversed, so you just kind of fucks you up a little bit. But find me there. Talk to me. Invite me to your town. I love meeting people, and hopefully I can bring one of my plays to your town.
Oh, that'd be great. Come to Seattle.
You have such a good theater town. I've been dying to come back with something. So I have been talking with a few people because I know that suicide awareness is a very big topic in your community, and I would love to bring my play up there.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we'd love it. Your website again was ZimmermanStan.com?
And my book, The Girls from Golden to Gilmore. You can buy it on Amazon or a million other places. And let me know your experiences of watching Golden Girls with your grandma, mama, mammy, ninny, nanny, whatever you call her.
Great. Grandy. My grandmother that watched Golden Girls preferred to be called Grandy because she thought...
Grandy, I love that.
Yeah, yeah. Gosh, yeah. She was kind of a bitch, though, to be honest. Okay.
Fuck her.
Well, our website is gayishpodcast.com.
We are on socials at Gayish Podcast.
Our hotline, you can send us text messages or leave us voicemails, especially if it's your gayest or straightest, is 5855-GAYISH. That's 585-542-9474. Standard rates apply.
Our email is gayishpodcast@gmail.com.
And our physical mailing address is Post Office Box 19882, Seattle, Washington, 98109. Quick programming note, our Patreon happy hour happens quarterly. No matter what level of Patreon support you are at, you can join us, have a cocktail, talk about the podcast, pants optional. The next one is Wednesday, May the 1st. That's at 6 p.m. Pacific. Yes,
Dan?
Come on. You want to come?
I'd love to. Yes, that'd be fun.
Great. Okay. We'll send you an invite.
Cocktail? You had me there. Yeah.
some of our listeners definitely don't wear pants to those things. But yeah,
I don't think you two are right now. So yeah.
Oh well,
I'll never tell.
I'll never tell. yeah, happy hours coming up on May 1st at 6 p.m. Pacific. Look in the Patreon app for the Zoom link. It's time for a gayest or straightest. Kyle, do you want to start us off?
Yeah, sure. So my straightest is similar to last week's. This week, I have not listened to the new Taylor Swift album.
Oh, okay.
I know that,
one, yeah.
That between Beyonce and Taylor, there are new albums out that I'm supposed to have listened to and become obsessed with already. And I just have not. So that's my straightest. My gayest is I went out to a nice dinner, so I got to dress up all cute. I don't really have too many reasons to dress real cute these days. So that was like a nice, fun excuse.
Was it with that boy you're seeing?
No, no. It was with an old work friend.
Oh, okay.
My other straightest is then I went to go eat a steak.
Steaks are gay. I eat what? A lot of steak. I will tell a secret, but Michael Urie, you know, from Ugly Betty and Shrinking, it's our thing. We'll go have martinis and steak. So that's pretty gay.
Okay. Okay. That's my other gayest then.
I think you need to like change the pronouns of your steak.
Mike, what about you?
What about me? The straightest thing about me this week is I'm leaving for San Francisco for work in about a half an hour and I have not packed yet. Just I feel like straight. It's very straight bro to just like not even care and just throw shit in a suitcase and go.
Mm-hmm.
The gayer thing would be to like fret over all of my outfits for the week or whatever.
Yeah, pack 10 outfits when you're going there for 3 days.
Exactly. And then the gayest thing about me this week is because of prep, my close personal relationship with my doctor has led me to yesterday's appointment, or 2 days ago, the appointment where he was talking to me about traveling to Argentina while he had a Q-tip actively up my ass.
Are you sure it was a Q-tip?
Yeah, well, I hope it was a Q-tip because it's not very complimentary to him if it was anything else. How about you, Stan? What's your gayest and straightest?
The gayest will be I just went to New York and, of course, I saw theater. Mm-hmm. And I saw two really gay plays. Oh, Mary, starring Cole Escola, who is friggin' hysterical. And then the show called Bathhouse PPTX. And there was about bathhouses, and there was some shoving of something up someone's butt on stage. Huh. So you don't get gayer than that. I think I won.
Wow. Yep. Oh, yeah.
100%.
100%. Done. And the straightest, I don't know, it probably goes the opposite of your traveling thing. So I have to do a work thing it's going to sound sad, but a work thing to Europe this summer. And the straightest thing was, like, I kept putting off, like, making the planes and doing like man things and being, for me, that was straight. And I just sat down and I figured it out and I programmed it and got it all the shit done And so I think that to me, that is straight. So maybe yep. that's not in your book, but that may seem very gay. So you see, it can go either way.
It can go either way. Yep.
So to speak.
Well, Stan Zimmerman, thank you so, so much for being on the show with us today. Really appreciate it.
Well, I love seeing you two laugh, and we need more of that.
Oh. Okay. Again, everybody, Stan's memoir, The Girls from Golden to Gilmore, you can get it on Amazon. Thank you so, so much for putting all of your wonderful content out in the world and making my relationship with my grandmother better.
Oh, my pleasure.
And I want to thank our Super Gap Bridgers. Thank you to Kaylee Adams, Kit Oliver, Pip, Andrew Bugby, William Bryant, John Carly, Stephen Porch, Yost Osel, Harry Shaw, Jonathan Montañez, Wadu Forrest, Neil Patrick Martin, Steve Douglas, Explosive Lasagna, Michael Cubbington, Just Jamie, Thomas B., Dusty Sands, A. Coleman, Chris Kachatorians, and Jerome York. Thank you for your support.
Thank you for your money. That's it. This has been Gayish from the Chris Cacciatore Studios. I'm Mike Johnson.
I'm Kyle Getz. Until next week, be butch, be fabulous, be you. See you next week.
See you next week. What's the gayest thing about you recently? What's the straightest thing about you recently? Like a big winner is always like if somebody works on their car or does like plumbing around the house, then like that's so butch, that's super straight. Mm-hmm.
Watching sports.
Yeah.
Oh, that won't be that.
Yeah.